there is always a gradient of, in the, it take the spine, that is the nervous system. Here you've got this huge bunch of cells that have a nuclear body, dendrite, and an axon that goes down the spine. Billions of them. That spine, that nervous system, is polarized with this as the negative region, which means there's a hell of a lot of electrical activity going on up here, and a lot less down here. So that the farther you get away from the collection of electrolytes, the less activity there is. And the amount of activity decreases successively till you get to the very end, where it is a very minimum of activity and as opposed to a maximum of activity. The point not to miss, put it graphically, there's a gradient, a continuum of electrical activity with no points, no lines of demarcation. There is no point along this line where you say, well, all of a sudden there's a difference, just little difference, increments or decrements of activity. I'm talking now strictly about electrolytes as an example of what the word polarity means, or gradient means, a polar gradient. That there is always that continuity of change of electrolytes to the a great deal of activity to almost or very little activity. So the farther you get away from the brain proper, the less activity there is. So that you get in your little toe, there are nervous fibrils out your little toe, in the skin of your little toe. Very, very little activity going out there as compared with an awful lot going on up here. Have you ever noticed that there is not much fat right along the spine on anybody? Why? Because there's so much electrical activity going on there. Why does the fat collect here? Because the muscles are so thin on your belly that there's not much electrical activity going there. And it was established in the 20s that if you have a solution and you have a negative pole over here and a positive pole over here, and you put some fat on this, the fat will migrate over to, the fat will migrate from the negative to the positive and deposit itself there. So you want to scare the fat away? Give yourself some shots with an electrode. But see, the principle is this: all living things are polarized, electrically polarized. Now, consider the element theory of energy. What does the element theory of energy say about? They don't say anything like this. They say that energy is in the elements. It's in there, inside it, property of the element. Field theory says, or polarity theory, or axis theory says, no way, Jose. The energy is not in those little particles at all. The energy is a field phenomenon. Now, I'm not going to badger with you that the mountains of research that were done in the 20s and 30s to show that this was the case, no matter where they looked, what kind of animal they looked at, they always found polarization. And it was always continuous. Graded increments. Never was energy found in places. Electrodes. Yeah, they were measuring electrical potential, that is the difference between one place and another. And as they got closer together with their electrodes, they found less difference. That's how they discovered the gradient phenomenon, by measuring electrical potential. And I said they even did it with corn seeds. They also showed the same phenomenon, that the greatest activity is on the periphery and the least is in the center of all living things, including man. Now, really, the ideas of the gradient, and indeed axiation, is not very useful when you're trying to understand madness. It's very useful when you're trying to understand growth and decrement of growth, but not madness. The important idea is, hey, that clock stopped. We've been going 2 hours, and I keep looking up there, and it's only 7 o'clock. Hey, let's take a break, huh? I'm sorry. I should. 7 o'clock, that doesn't make sense anyway. And then get into the problem of body and mind. I think for our purposes, the theory of type or equifinality is the most important idea coming out of holism, and I want to point out that it does come from holism, and I've shown the specific derivation, that it's one expression of the principle of closure or pattern completion. The idea is that form is inherent, that what a person does is absolutely predetermined as far as form is concerned. Yes. Type, equifinality. That's Bertalanffy's word, equifinality. It's Greek is Latin, equi, meaning same, a final finis, and same end. All of the things we do are moving toward the same end. Each of our acts has the same final goal. Yes, it's that our behavior is predetermined, insofar as we are talking about pattern. And the analogy of the acorn and the oak tree is, I think, appropriate, that the acorn knows what to do to become an oak tree. And won't do anything else. Or if the acorn does something other than or away from becoming an oak tree, then the acorn won't repeat that. But recurrent behaviors, habits, if you will, or characteristic behaviors, or typical behaviors, are all characteristic or habitual or typical, precisely because they all have the same goal. That is to say, the final form. It's as if each living thing has a distant goal and hones in on it. And has in every cell, so to speak, the pattern to follow in let's say, knowing what to do. It's called teleology, is another name for it, which is just Greek for telos and logos, whatever that means, the gathering of ends. But this flies in the face of the doctrine that we do what we do because of circumstances, that the surrounding circumstances determine what we do. This notion says our character. It is in our character, our nature, to act as we do. We really don't have any choice in the matter. What we do and how we do it, then, in this view, is always, let's say, if it is recurrent, and I'm granting that there are some, let's say, we get off course now and then, and we do some things that are not in keeping with our character, but we don't repeat them. The things that we repeat because they move us toward the final mature form. That's the postulate or the hypothesis or the principle or the law, the law type. Now that, said simply, is that no matter what we do, if it is a recurrent thing, is done in character. It is in our nature to act thus and so. So that we are not the passive victim of circumstances, as Watson would say, as the behaviorist would say. We are not shaped by the environment. Our shape is inherent, immanent, given. Both our shape in the sense of our physique and the shape of our actions is given from the very beginning. Now, that together with the eighth law, the law of differentiation, which is one of the principles of unfolding or evolution, those two laws are very heavily used in the holistic theory of madness. Now, what is the theory of differentiation or heterogeneity? That law says that structure, or whatever structure there is, unfolds progressively. It's almost as if everything is already there, just folded, like a chrysalis. And once you get out of the oven, you start expanding, branching. This is the branching theory, the spreading out theory of development, of physical development. The body progressively expands. You can see it. You can even watch mitosis under a microscope. You can see cells dividing into one cell dividing into two cells. It polarizes, have a negative charge over here and positive over here. The material in the cell will migrate over to those two poles, and then all of a sudden a membrane will form between, and you've got two cells, and so on, and so on, and so on. A progressive differentiation or expansion or separation. The theory of development here is one of separation, not concretion, not getting together, not coming together of separate parts, but of the expansion and separation of a basic unity. Now, the living, The person never loses its unity, never. The expansion or development or spreading out or arborization is possible only because of a prior unity, a prior oneness. And that oneness is never lost. The trunk of a tree is always there to support the limbs. And each limb is always there to support the branches. And so it is with the human being. The base or the ground is always there to support the separation of the parts, so that the parts of a living being follow and come after the unified whole, not before. You see, atomism has it the other way around. The unified whole comes from the concretion or concatenation or addition or the collection of disparate parts. And then, and only then, comes the cooperation and activity. Not so, says differentiation theory and type theory. It's the reverse. Yeah. Now that is an addendum to that, each individual is absolutely unique. However, as soon as you, here's a final mature form, either of the physique or of one's activities. As soon as you define a form, you not only can show how that form is different from some other form, but you can show how that form is similar to another form. So now you have classes or categories or kinds of form, kinds of form of behavior. You can have kinds of patterns, categories of patterns. Now, it's true each one of these is unique, but think of the crystal, a polygon, say a six-sided crystal, and you have 10 six-sided crystals. Each one is a little different from every other one, but they're all six-sided crystals. Now, you compare that six-sided crystal to, say, a four-sided crystal, like a pyramid. Notice the enormous difference between the four-sided crystal and the six-sided crystal. You can have a whole bunch of pyramids, each one unique, yet sharing in common that basic form. So at once you have uniqueness, absolutely uniqueness, and yet similarity, do you not? So it is now with type theory. INFPs, for instance, and this is a type theory, are quite different from ESTJs. Radically different from everything. And yet they're very much like another INFP, are they not? Granted that there are differences even among INFPs. Great difference, but not as much difference as the INFP from the ESTJ. And so now when we get into the abnormal, when a six-sided crystal starts doing goofy stuff, you're going to see six-sided crystalline goofy stuff. And it'll be quite different from three-sided crystalline goofy stuff.
What about cultural?
In field theory, the field is what you're talking about. The environment in holism is called the field, or the base, or the ground. The
surrounding conditions for an event make possible, on the one hand, the event occurring, that thing happening. And it limits, on the other hand, what can happen. So if, for instance, there's not enough oxygen to breathe, then that's going to limit your breathing, and you're probably going to split the scene to get somewhere where there's plenty of oxygen. So it does those two things. It sets limits on what's possible to happen, and on the other hand, enables what can happen. So it enables and makes possible the occurrence of events. And we speak of the necessary and sufficient conditions under which an event occurs. The necessary and sufficient conditions under which an event occurs. Now that's the way Hollis taught.
You cannot separate the two.
An event always, right. I trust you mean the conditions for an event and the event. There cannot be an event outside of a field. It's always figure and ground. There is no possible way that something can be outside of an environment, outside of its own environment. I mean, that's a matter of definition. A human being, for instance, is always in some environment. It's unthinkable to have a human being outside of any environment. And that environment must make it possible for that organism to continue to survive. If it doesn't, the organism dies. So yes, the field for an event is a field for an event.
Are you saying at the same time that the field does not cause behavior?
Well, you're mixing two things. That's right. I'm not saying that. That's very accurate. I'm not saying that. See that to meet those words, let's get to the why I brought all this up in the first place. Aside from asserting that the theory of types comes from holism, what about the problem of body and mind? And I'm saying, now, if you don't come to terms with this problem, it will haunt you the rest of your life. Descartes was not the first guy to say mind and body are separate realms, domains, separate, independent. Each has its own field. But he did, because of the exigencies at the time, find it necessary to say this, to get the church off the back of the scientists so they could study nature. Otherwise, they're going to get burned off the stake. So he made the separation. Mind is one thing, body is another thing. It's okay to study the body. Then he said, gee, you wonder what relationship there is between body and mind. And he didn't really have any good ideas about just what that relationship might be. He said that the connection between body and mind is the pineal gland up in the middle of the head. how whatever it is that goes from body to mind gets into and out of that little organ, no one has ever explained. But you know, that's as good as psychosomatic or psychomotor. Now, what happened then was that he reified mind, reified that he made it real, made it a thing, made it something. Mind now was something, an entity. To be sure, an insubstantial entity, but an entity nonetheless, a thing. Mind now became a noun instead of a verb. Instead of mind your manners, mind your own business, mind the store, mind the kids, bear this, mind this, mind you, it became a noun, a something. Now you've got the problem. Well, if you have this something, the body, and this something, the mind, is there any relationship between them? Do they relate to it? Can the body communicate with the mind? Can the mind communicate with the body? Can the mind get the body to do something? Can the body get the mind to do something? You know, all these questions came up. And you know, those of you who are in psychology know the history of this problem, and if people kept throwing up their hands trying to answer what was, in effect, an insoluble problem. Because you had the impossible idea of an insubstantial entity, a non-spatial entity. See, they didn't say it was juice or air. That, well, it's its own thing, and we all know what it is. And of course, nowadays we have a question. You can hear it everywhere you listen. Can the mind affect the body? Can the body affect the mind? Well, thinking that way, if you think of mind as a thing, then it's natural to ask what sorts of things does the mind do? If it's a thing, and if it's not just a box sitting there, then it can do stuff, can't it? Well, get your mind to control your body. Is it not the case that you yourselves have thought, well, sure, the mind controls the body, doesn't it? That makes sense to you? Can the mind cause the body to get sick? Oh, a lot of people would say, sure. Mary Baker Eddy said that. The mind can cause the body to get sick. The mind can do marvelous things. Well, is madness caused by the body getting the mind to do funny things? Well, that seems sort of reasonable, doesn't it? Suppose you get a broken brain. Now, the brain is part of the body, isn't it? It's an organ of the body. And the broken brain now is said to get the mind to go haywire. And the mind in turn gets the body to do some funny things, having gone haywire because of the broken brain. Do you see how this reasoning can get you to say some pretty goofy things? Is epilepsy organically caused? Does epilepsy have an organic cause? Is it a bad brain that causes epilepsy? Is it a bad brain that causes dyslexia? Is it a bad brain, a broken brain, that causes hyperactivity? Is it not? Since you give the kids who are, quote, hyperkinetic or hyperactive, since you give them juice of various kinds, and then they become quite docile, does that not prove then that it was a broken brain, or some wrong brain, minimal brain dysfunction anyway, that the cells weren't undulating properly or something, and that's the cause of the hyperkinesis or the hyperactivity, and that's proven by the fact that when you give them some certain kinds of juice, especially speed, that therefore, and that they calm down, quote, calm down, they become docile anyway, that therefore it must have been a broken brain that caused this kind of behavior. Do we not talk that way? Are there not thousands of articles talking exactly that way? Are there not thousands of physicians, psychiatrists, neurologists looking for the physical causes of schizophrenia today? So it's the manufacture of this ghostly entity, the mind, that has, I believe, made it possible to pursue research like that, trying to find either the bad juice or the bad flesh to explain why this bad behavior on the part of the mind. Notice that it is the mind that is behaving now. What is the solution to this problem? There isn't any solution to this problem. The problem is self-defeating. Now, one of you asked, well, what do the holists have to say about the problem? I say, well, it isn't a problem. If you don't want to have to explain the relationship between the mental entity and the physical entity, don't make up a mental entity. And then you won't have to explain how in the devil an insubstantial mental entity can cooperate or coagulate or do anything else with a substantial entity. Just don't make up such a fiction in the first place, and you won't have the problem of explaining the relationship. Just say that mind, which is a perfectly good Germanic word, is what the body does. Mind is the activity of the body. Look at my finger. I got this from Professor Wheeler, 1933. He says, look at my finger. It's wiggling, isn't it? Where's the wiggle? Is the wiggle in the finger? Is it on the finger? No. Is it beside the finger? With the finger? Does it accompany the finger? He says, no, none of it. It's of the finger. It is the wiggle of the finger. The wiggle is of the finger. If there were no finger there, there wouldn't be no wiggle there. But the wiggle is not the finger, and it's not in it, and it's not on it. It's not from it, or to it, or with it. It is of it. Wiggle is behavior. It takes, let's say, wiggle is the function of a structure. The finger is the structure, and the wiggle is the function. Now, no way can you ever change that function into a structure. It is. It's a function. It's something that the finger does. So then it is with mind. Mind is what the brain does. Just as the finger wiggles, the brain minds. Just as the stomach digests, the brain minds. Just as the muscular apparatus, that is the skeletal system, contracts the brain minds, just as the heart circulates the blood, the brain minds, just as the lungs respire, the brain minds. What's the relationship between the brain and the mind? The mind is of the brain. There isn't any other relationship. It is a verb. Change the word mind back to its verb form, its action form, its behavior form, its function. Think of mind as a function of brain. Now you got no problem. There are some problems. I'm not going to kid you on that. There are some problems. The problem of will, for instance. But those are, you can deal with that problem. But as long as that mind, word mind, is a noun, an entity, a thing, you've got insoluble problems, and I say again, it's going to get you into this same boat that everybody else is in of saying silly things like a broken brain causes the mind to go bananas. And then the mind that has gone bananas turns around and gets the body to do goofy things. And that's, now that's insanity. But the solution is to not create the problem in the first place. Then you don't have to deal with it. Just think, whenever you hear the word mind, or its Greek and Latin translations, and I'll give you those, you're talking about a verb and not a noun. And then you won't get into this trap. You can't get out of it. As long as you have reified or objectified or entified mind, you've got problems that have plagued psychology ever since psychology was invented. And you might well ask, well, it's so simple and so obvious. I don't know. Is it obvious? It's so simple to me, I can't understand how all of this came to be in the first place. But you may well ask, well, if it's so simple and so obvious, how come psychology as so-called science hasn't been aware of this? It's because psychologists never heard of it. Psychologists never read anything about it. They had no access to it. Because remember, the people that talked this way all died, and they all spoke lousy English. They were Germans. Now, if you hang on to that idea for a while anyway, and toy with it, entertain it, see if you can digest it, then I say you can think holistically. If you don't, you can't. I've seen through the many, many years that I've been teaching, I've seen most students regress back and revert back to this idea of pieces of flesh causing mind to do things. And that reasoning is so circular, and it gets you nowhere at all. And it gets you to saying things like, well, that's psychosomatic, or that's psychomotor, or that's a neurotransmitter, other weird things like that, yeah.
So in that sense, can you use mind as narrow sense as say it's synonymous with think as a verb?
No.
But it's in a wider sense than that, but it's still a verb.
Well, I would say that thinking is one form of minding.
Yes.
Minding the store, for instance, minding your business, minding somebody else's business. Yeah, thinking is, that's one way to mind. Now mind me. Pay attention. Paying attention is one form of minding. but there are other forms. So yes and no. Now you get into all of these things. Thinking and feeling are two forms of minding. Thinking is not feeling, and feeling is not thinking, but they're both minding. Now, we get to the naughty question, what about wanting something? Is that minding? No. A little work to do there. But it's not insoluble. Like the question of what is the relationship between the mental entity and the physical entity? You know, that's insoluble. It's a never-ending, century after century paradox. You get nowhere. It's time to go.